You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
The Employment Rights Bill, introduced to Parliament on the 10th of October 2024, is the first phase of delivering Labour's plan to make work pay. There have been many private members' bills on various aspects of employment law, including the banning of zero-hours contracts, but they've never made it to a second reading. So this bill is big news. It's said that even at this early stage, this legislation may be the opening salvo in what may be the most significant change to employment law for many years. I have here with me to discuss the bill Alistair Henderson of One Crown Office Row. Ali has particular interests and expertise in employment and equality law, as well as in public law and human rights. Joining Ali is former One Crown Office Row barrister Henry Tufnell, who is now Member of Parliament for Mid and South Pembrokeshire. Before leaving the bar, Henry also specialised in public and employment law. So now to the bill itself, which is at the committee stage in the House of Commons. Anyone who's had a brief look at the bill online will realise it's far too bulky for one of our 30 to 40 minute episodes of LawPod UK. So we'll be focusing on some of the main features of the bill. Over to you, Ali.
Hi, Rosalind and Henry, and great to talk to you about this important piece of legislation. As you say, Rosalind, this is a massive and wide-ranging bill, so we're going to zoom in on just a few of the most significant or interesting features. And what I'm going to do is introduce each of these, ask Henry, as MP for the governing party, who's going to be voting on this bill and is supportive of it, to explain what's intended and what it's all about. And then I'm going to try and play devil's advocate, or maybe just be a good legislator or a constructive member of the opposition, better put, and try and pick some holes in it or just raise some questions about how this is going to work in practice. I want to start with the proposed reforms to zero-hours contracts, which is found in clauses 1 to 6 of the bill. Henry, help us with what are zero-hours contracts and what is this bill intending to do to change the current situation?
Well, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. Ali was my people supervisor when I was working as a barrister at One Crown Office Row during my pupillage. So it's nice to be back and nice to be with you here today. So in terms of zero-hours contracts, I think the structure of the whole thing, as you said, it's a sort of almost generational moment to reset that relationship between the workers and capital, right? From a Labour Party perspective. So it's an incredibly exciting moment. And if you're focusing, as you always taught me to do, focus down on the detail very quickly, from the point of view in terms of zero-hours contracts, I think the key thing here is that right to guaranteed hours. So, you know, a lot of time I'm out talking to employers in Pembrokeshire, you know, you're meeting with businesses in Westminster, and they talk about this kind of flexibility. But from the worker's perspective, you could show up at work, maybe you've got a child, you're a single parent, you pay for childcare, you arrive at work, and there is no work, right? And that's not right, right? From a Labour Party perspective, we're there to represent the interests of workers, and we think that needs to change. And that's why we have this piece of legislation coming into the House. And that's why it was a key part of our manifesto. I mean, fundamentally, taking a big step back is that we don't think that there's a trade-off between economic growth and workers' rights protection. We think they go hand in hand as a way to lift living standards right across the board. So that's the intention. And that's the sort of rationale in respect to those specific clauses around banning zero-hours contracts. I mean, the only thing I'd say in addition to that is that the ramifications will be massive. So over 1 million people who are on zero-hours contracts will benefit from the guaranteed hours policy. So the ramifications of the policy and the legislation will be far-reaching. And I think that's, well, from someone in terms of being a Labour MP, you know, standing on that platform. It's an incredibly proud moment to be able to vote on that and to be part of that legislation going through the Houses of Parliament.
Great. Thanks, Henry. Well, also, it's very laudable and well-intentioned. But as you say, the devil's always in the detail. Now, before and after your time as a barrister, you worked for a trade union representing a lot of cleaners and other so-called gig economy workers. I think it was called the Cleaners and Allied Independent Workers Union. Is that right? CIWU. So you'd have got to know a lot of people for whom zero-hours contracts were a very major part of their lives. Can you help us just understand a little bit more about what the problems are in practice and how the Employment Rights Bill is intended to address those practical problems?
If you go through this particular part of the legislation, you have right to guaranteed hours, you have rights to reasonable notice for shifts, you have right to payment for cancelled, moved or curtailed shifts. All of those provisions are providing greater power to the worker. And the people who are members of CIWU, who worked in the cleaning industry, were often first generation into the UK in terms of migrating into the UK, were there because often language was a big barrier. There's a cultural difficulty in terms of trying to understand the complicated nature of UK law and what that means from a cultural perspective. And within that context, all this stuff is ripe for abuse. I think the Resolution Foundation found that 14% of the lowest paid workers report they'd received no holiday, which is five times higher than the highest paid. And you've also got 11% of low paid workers, so they didn't get a pay slip. And that's twice as many of those in higher paid professions. So there's a big disparity in terms of the impact and where that impact hits in terms of society. So the bottom end in terms of pay get hit the hardest. And they're the ones that are going to benefit from this legislation, particularly on this point around 0 hours contracts.
Great. So the intention is to try and help particularly those, as you say, the kind of the bottom ends of pay and conditions and give them the most benefit. But let's just step back for a second. Isn't part of the problem with regulating 0 hours contracts much more that actually you might reduce the number of jobs available for people who are on these kind of 0 hours contracts or more flexible employment, and therefore potentially put them out of a job as a whole? Or possibly it means that because there's restrictions on how much you can do in a 0 hours contract set up, there'll be fewer hours that they're available to work. And therefore, again, that's going to reduce the amount of employment they've got and the amount of money they can earn.
But there'd be no impediment to like working more. It's a baseline. So at the moment, there's nothing in the context of a 0 hours contract. And then the employer has to hit a certain level in terms of how many hours they guaranteed for an individual worker.
Yes, but what about if an employer would have potentially given quite a lot of people a bit of work flexibly on various 0 hours contracts, and instead, because of this additional regulation, they're going to end up giving fewer jobs to fewer people. And as a result, quite a lot of people lose out, particularly those who are more vulnerable or who are on lower paid or less significant terms and conditions.
What, so rather than having one person who has the capacity to go up to a huge amount of hours, you have lots of people that are all on the same level? I mean, but that's going to depend a lot on the nature of the business and the capability that that business needs to do. I mean, it would be different as to whether you're trying to run a coffee shop or trying to clean a building or monitoring a till at checkout. I mean, that's going to vary enormously depending on the nature of the business and the requirements of the employer.
Yes, exactly. It might well be that it's preferable for some businesses to have lots of people who they can give a bit of work to, and that's good for both the business and for them, than to have to provide a certain minimum amount to a smaller number of people. That actually might not be as helpful or as flexible for quite a lot of people.
I mean, I don't think so, because what you're allowing for is you're allowing the worker to have certainty and security about the work that they're doing. So it's going to provide a better relationship between the employer and the employee. And if you have a greater sense of equality of power in that relationship, it makes for a happier outcome rather than you having loads of disgruntled employees that, you know, there's no guarantee about how many hours they're going to get. There's no notice about when or when their shifts might not appear. Obviously, we're talking about bad in quotation marks, employers who are going to act like that. I mean, the vast majority of employers are good employers. There's good relationships. But, you know, those kind of basic rights need to be in place in order to provide that level of power and agency within the workplace.
Sure. Okay. So it totally depends, obviously, on the particular business and the particular facts on the ground of whatever the employment situation is.
Yeah.
But let's take an obvious kind of general example. What about seasonal work, right? So agriculture, time of harvesting or time of planting, you need much more labour for those particular times. And it might be helpful both to the people who are employed and to the employer to be able to ramp up the amount of hours for a particular period, but not have to keep providing them over a longer period. Or, for example, let's take Christmas. Lots of retail and hospitality businesses will want to bring in lots more seasonal staff for the Christmas period. Are you going to make that much more difficult for them and therefore reduce the number of jobs available at a time when quite often people want some extra work?
But that sounds like overtime, doesn't it? I mean, if you're working in the Christmas period, you'd get overtime for working extra shifts because there's an increase in demand in sales in the shop, for example.
Okay, so Christmas. So lots of the retail and hospitality sector will want to ramp up their employees' hours or give new people work just for the Christmas period. Won't these changes make it much more difficult for them to do that and therefore lose those jobs or lose those extra hours for people?
Well, I think it will require planning from an employer point of view in terms of managing their workforce. But I think having better management from an employer point of view is only a good thing in terms of working out, okay, if I have six employees over the Christmas period, if I get overtime from four of them, is that going to tie us over? Or do I actually need to be thinking that I need to have five employees and I need to manage it a bit better? I mean, it sounds like more of a preparation point and a case-by-case basis depending on the individual business. I mean, the fundamental point, again, comes back to providing a baseline for the worker in terms of the guaranteed hours, the rights to a reasonable notice, and that right payment for cancelled, moved or curtailed shifts.
Now, I think we need to move on to a second topic, and that's going to be clause 15 to 18, but particularly clause 16 of the bill, which are all to do with protection from harassment. Now, a little bit of context here is important. The Equality Act 2010 originally contained provisions for making it unlawful for employers to allow third-party harassment. In other words, harassment of their workers, not by other employees, but by a third party, such as a client or a customer. That was removed. And then very recently, just last year, the Worker Protection Act came into force, which added it back in relation to sexual harassment only. So not harassment in terms of other protected characteristics like race or disability or religion or belief, but specifically sexual harassment. So not harassment in relation to sex, but sexual in nature. And that third-party harassment provision came back in. But this employment rights bill wants to go further, and it wants to ramp up the duty on employers to take steps against sexual harassment by third parties. It wants to add in clause 15, the word all, to make it that they have to take all reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment against their employees. So it kind of makes it harder. And then also, Clause 16 introduces measures to protect employees from harassment more broadly, so not just sexual harassment. Now, again, Henry, it'd be helpful to get your understanding of what the intention behind this is, because obviously this sounds like a good piece of protection for workers, but a concern's been raised that this could be a bit onerous for employers, particularly, for example, if you run a hospitality venue, you say you run a pub and you've got some clients, some customers who are, you know, saying something a bit risque or a bit offensive in the corner, and one of your employees takes offence at that and feels harassed, isn't that quite a lot of a burden to put on, say, a pub owner?
You've used the example of the pub, but I suppose from my perspective, the instance where I use the previous provisions, and it gets quite complicated from the employment law in terms of how it's used at the moment as opposed to when it would be used after this legislation, was always in the context of outsourced workers. So in the cleaning industry, the majority of the work is always outsourced. So you'd have, for instance, a cleaner who's employed by, let's say, Mitie or ISS or whoever it is, but they work in Goldman Sachs or they work in JP Morgan, or it's in a hospital situation, they're working in the hospital, but they're employed by Mitie. So you have a direct employer-employee relationship between the cleaner and the agency, but then you're working in another area that you don't have that direct relationship. And so if the cleaner is being harassed by a banker in JP Morgan, it becomes much more difficult to try and bring a claim. How does that work? I think effectively what the legislation is trying to do is trying to beef up that protection in terms of harassment. Because at the moment, on a practical level, dealing with it was quite difficult to do. because of the way that these employment structures have been set up over, well, they've changed effectively. The legislation hasn't kept up with the nature of the changing employment situation that we've had with the increasing large-scale outsourcing that's happened, both in the public and in the private sector.
Great. So the real focus here, especially with the sexual harassment stuff, is to deal with, as you say, kind of outsourced contractors who are treated badly by essentially the client who really is working as their primary contact, their primary person they're coming into contact with. Does that create a difficulty in relationships, though, between who's really responsible? So it sounds like you're adding in a protection for the worker, but does it actually make it even more difficult for them to bring a claim?
Yeah, and there's also the conflict as well, right? That Mitie, in the example I used, and JP Morgan, sorry to throw the banks under the bus, but you know, it's going to be a difficult relationship for Mitie to come at JP Morgan, who's, they're effectively, JP Morgan are paying Mitie. So it becomes a difficult relationship. And if the rules aren't clear enough, the person that loses out is the cleaner that's in an unsafe work environment because they're suffering harassment, sexual or otherwise.
So that all sounds like it's trying to deal with a current gap in the law quite effectively. But let's step back and think about particularly not the sexual harassment part of this, but the wider harassment on other protected characteristics that would apply for third parties. So one of the concerns that's been raised here, indeed was raised when the Worker Protection Act was going through Parliament last year, was that this could have a chilling effect on freedom of expression, particularly in, as I mentioned already, the kind of retail or hospitality sectors. So let's take the example, you know, an entertainment venue. They have a comedian who gets booked. It's perfectly lawful what the comedian's talking about, but as quite a lot of comedy is, it's maybe a bit offensive to some people. And you have employees who say, we really hate this, we don't like it. This is an unwanted environment that's being created because this comedian's saying what he or she is saying on the stage. Doesn't that effectively mean that you're putting employers in a tricky position where they're going to be policing the speech, policing the otherwise free expression of comedians or other entertainers? And that's creating a real kind of, it's part of the kind of cancel culture thing that lots of people have been worried about recently.
I mean, it's quite a high bar there, isn't it? The definition of harassment. And I say that just because I do worry sometimes that it's salacious for the media. It goes down this sort of culture war route. And the effect of that is to distract from the intention, which is to try and protect people in their workplace, right? It's not really a freedom of speech issue. And people make it out as such under slightly false premises because there's not really a discussion about, A, how high that threshold is in terms of to meet that harassment definition, but also because it becomes a distraction from the actual intention of the legislation in of itself. And it becomes fire for certain people when it becomes a free speech agenda. I mean, you know, free speech is good. We live in a democracy. I speak to people all the time about, you know, they say, oh, no, I shouldn't say this. No, go on, say it. You need to say stuff. Otherwise, you bottle it up or you don't have a discussion about it and then you can't flesh it out. So I'm not a proponent of clamping down on free speech, but I just don't think that's the issue here. It's just about trying to protect people in their workplace.
Can I just intervene quickly here and ask whether we have a definition of what clears the bar for what is harassment? Or is that awaiting a regulation for the purposes of the bill?
You got it in front of you, Ali.
Yeah, I've got that in front of me. And as I understand it, it is just the same definition as is in the Equality Act generally, but applied to third parties. So harassment means a person harasses another person if they, A, engage in unwanted conduct related to a relevant protected characteristic, and B, the conduct has the purpose or effect, so intention or effect, of violating that person's dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, or offensive environment for them. And the rest of the provision goes on to say that there's both a subjective and an objective element to deciding whether or not it amounts to that. So in other words, what's the actual effect on the person? What do they say it was? But also, is it reasonable for them to have had that effect on them? So that's the definition.
Yeah, thank you, Ali. I think we do have to keep that in mind and keep the definition of what constitutes harassment because it's easily forgotten.
Let's move on to our third topic now, which is one of the other really significant proposals in the Employment Rights Bill, and that is changing the unfair dismissal protections, so the right to claim unfair dismissal, to a day one right. So unfair dismissal, just to catch everyone up, originally was you had to be employed for a full year before you could get it. Then some time ago, many years ago, it was changed to being 2 years. So you have to be employed for 2 years in order to be able to claim unfair dismissal. And one of the big changes proposed in this bill is to make it effectively a day one right. But interestingly, with a slight caveat for the first few months, that there is still the ability to have a probationary period. So Henry, tell us, what's the purpose of this? What's the intention? Why is it considered important to make this change?
Well, it goes back to trying to strengthen the rights of the individual worker. I mean, we had, when I was at Kaiwi, we had loads of people who were coming in and didn't meet the two-year threshold, so weren't able to bring a claim. And I think it's important that strengthening within the legislation is put in there. Just to be clear, I think it is important that there is a probationary period. And currently it's being discussed as whether it's 6, 9, or 12 months. I think the government is suggesting 9, but you know, obviously that's a significant change from a two-year one. But if you haven't worked out whether or not your employee is the right fit for the role within 2 years, I don't know what's going on with you and your business or your situation. You should know pretty quickly whether or not the person you've employed is the right person for the job. 2 years seems to be a really, really long period of time for the worker to have to go through in order to qualify for some kind of rights on their part within their employment.
Okay, so that's the idea. But going from 2 years to a day one right is equally quite a significant pendulum swing, isn't it? And I flagged already, I think one of the key issues here is what's going to happen with probationary periods. So most employers entirely reasonably think we want to have a bit of time when we've hired somebody to check that they're actually a good fit, they're actually, you know, as good as they say they are, that they actually work well in the team and so on. That's surely a crucial thing to maintain. And it seems that there's still a bit of discussion going on about whether or not that's going to be maintained. And if so, in what way? Is it going to be 6 months? Is it going to be 12 months? So this is an area where there's been quite a lot of back and forth. One of the issues there is it seems to have been both kicked down the road. So this isn't going to come in until sometime after the Act passes, but also that quite a lot of the detail is now being put in regulations and secondary legislation, which seems to indicate there's been a bit of pushback, and also this is quite tricky in practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been that real hot talking point, hasn't it? I think when it was initially sort of proposed, it was, you know, real rights from day one. And then I think businesses got a bit nervous about that. I agree with them. I don't think from day one you should have that. I think there should be a qualifying period, whether that's 6, 9, or 12 months. I think it's unrealistic to say that immediately the employer is not able to make a quick decision about whether it's a good fit or not. These things are currently being worked out at the moment. I'm not Justin Madders. I'm not right at the coalface on this, but clearly it's a moving picture. Obviously, simple legislation makes for good legislation, but you know, I think it's the right decision to have that qualifying period, whether it be 6, 9, or 12 months. But fundamentally, the point is about giving those added protections to the worker. And that's what we're trying to do with this piece of legislation.
All right, let's move on to our second last topic, which is clauses 26 to 27, which add in some new jitties on employers relating to equality. And in particular, clause 26 adds a new section to the Equality Act 2010, which provides for regulations to be made that are going to require employers to publish an equality action plan, setting out how they're going to tackle the gender pay gap and supporting workers during menopause. And then also, clause 27 allows for more regulation to require publishing of information about outsourced workers by employers as well. So this is expanding the scope of the gender pay gap regulation that already exists and requiring potentially employers to publish equality action plans. So not just to kind of record what men and women are being paid and potential discrepancies or a gap, but also say, what are we going to do about that? What are the causes and how are we going to take that forwards? Now, this obviously, again, sounds well-intentioned, but is it really going to make a significant difference to the existing duty to record information and data that would record any gender pay gap? And isn't it just an additional burden on employers at a time when the Labour Party is trying to stimulate economic growth? Give us a sense here of what's the idea behind all of this, Henry.
You have to be over 250 people though, right? So you don't need me to tell you that there's an issue with the gender pay gap. There shouldn't be such a discrepancy in terms of pay as to whether you're a man or a woman. And so trying to encourage employers to take that seriously, to try and reduce that gap, is a good thing. And so trying to have a systematic way of a roadmap to reducing it and having some provision in that within legislation is a positive step in the right direction.
All right, but what seems to be happening is this is a classic example of, sadly, what's happened a lot in legislation over the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years, and certainly is happening in this bill, which is that quite a lot of the detail is being pushed into secondary legislation and then delegated potentially to the EHRC as a regulator. That's not going to do much good unless there's significant resource given to the EHRC to be an effective regulator. And currently, they don't have much, but also unless that regulation is thought through well and there's good consultation about it. So isn't it slightly kicking the can down the road, or sort of virtue signalling rather than actually achieving something concrete?
So I don't think it's necessarily clear at the moment, you know, in terms of more meat on the bone from a detail point of view than what I've set out, which is that we accept that there's a gender pay gap. We don't think that's good. And we want to try and create a roadmap for it. You know, we think that employers over 250 in terms of the number of employees means that business will be sufficiently resourced to be able to have that extra administration, and that that's an appropriate way of addressing this problem within our society, that there's this discrepancy on pay.
I don't think it's kick it into consultation. It's a noble aim. It's a good cause. It's important that it works effectively and, you know, delivers on the actual intention from the outset of what we're trying to do.
Okay, great. Well, let's hope that the consultation and the detail on the regulations works, and it does achieve that. Our final topic to cover is part four of the bill, which concerns changes to trade union rights. Now, there's a lot in this. Some of it is repealing or amending the provisions of the Trade Union Act 2016, which was passed by the previous Conservative government. Some of it is introducing new provisions, such as strengthening the blacklisting protections or protections against detriment or dismissal for engaging in union activity. Now, obviously, the Labour Party has always had a very close relationship with the unions, so in one sense, it's no surprise that a new Labour government might want to do something in relation to trade union rights. But what's being proposed in the bill is quite extensive. So, Henry, help us with why these changes and why now?
Well, I think if you step back a bit and you look at the way in which we view trade unions, which effectively comes, you know, I'm only 32, right? But comes from a Thatcher era of direct confrontation between the unions, seeing the unions as the enemy to economic growth, to prosperity, right? And over time, since the 1980s, you've seen a marked decline, particularly in the private sector, of trade union membership. Public sector's not done as so badly, but in the private sector, it's gone down and down and down and down. And the result of that has been a bottoming out of workplace protections. You could go into other things in terms of that sense of community, identity, and that sense of belonging as well within the trade union movement. But if you look at it from a quite sort of transactional way, in terms of the rights, in terms of the wages, I mean, wage growth in this country in real terms haven't grown since about 2005. It's like the longest period in terms of stagnation since the Napoleonic Wars. Fundamentally, that's not a good thing for society. You know, people don't have money in their pocket. They're not going to go and spend it down the shops. They're not going to spend it on something for the weekend. And in the long term, that hurts everyone. So there's that sort of like macro perspective.
But the classic response to this would be, surely it's putting more burden on employers and more pressure on them in terms of union relations. And when everything's going great economically, that's maybe fine. But when the economy isn't in great shape, as it isn't now, and there's a huge need to encourage innovation and growth, as the government recognises, is this really the right time?
I appreciate some people will have different views, and it's one of the biggest reasons why I'm in the Labour Party. But fundamentally, the trade unions are an ally of employers, are an ally of business, that creating a positive working environment between the two can lead to a more prosperous and a thriving business. The trade unions are not, you know, they're not there to throw everything out. Working in the cleaning industry with Kywood, we wanted cleaning businesses to be successful, because if they're successful, then the workers are successful. They don't lose their jobs. They don't have to get redundant. They can get a pay rise. They work together. And I think if you can, trying to ensure that there is that working together and that is put in kind of some kind of formalized setting is a good thing, because in some cases it was a complete nightmare trying to deal with employers. And that was just because there was a complete sense of not wanting to engage and seeing us as the enemy. And that doesn't help them. That doesn't help the worker. Doesn't help the, it creates a complete animosity where nothing gets done and everyone walks away angry. And it doesn't need to be like that.
So the aim really is to achieve a sort of reset from an antagonistic relationship to a more cooperative one between employers and the union, because the antagonistic one doesn't achieve anything. But this is obviously against the backdrop of a series of strikes in the public sector in particular in the last few years, such as the NHS with junior doctors. And that's why a key part of the 2016 Act was minimum service level requirements in certain key public services or industries that strikes couldn't interfere with. But that's one of the things that this bill is going to repeal. Is there not a danger that this is going to create more of the same problems or replace one problem, overly antagonistic relationship, with another?
But I think that it got to that stage because of the government's attitude to the trade unions, right? There was such limited engagement. It became a political football that you say, oh, well, the waiting lists have gone up because the junior doctors are on strike. The outcome is not good because of the trade unions. Rather than saying, we're all in the same boat, we're all working together, we all want the waiting lists to come down, so we have to collectively work together in order to try and sort out this problem. So it's an attitude problem from government. The Labour Party, since we come in, we completely reset that relationship. I mean, if you look at the train strikes, the strikes in respect to the hospitals, it's so different from what it was under the Conservatives.
But the Labour government has resolved things like the junior doctor strike by basically throwing money at the problem, hasn't it? Rather than a major cultural reset or legislative change.
But they should get a pay rise. I mean, the fact that the wages have been so stagnant for such a long period of time is not a good thing. And that just hollows out our NHS, that hollows out our public services. And we want good public services. We want to value those public services. And if we want to do that, we have to pay the people that work in them a proper wage. That's a fundamental pillar of our society. And people need to make that connection, that if they want good public services, there has to be a way to pay for them.
So what the government's trying to achieve here is both increasing pay and hopefully economic growth to pay for that, to increase the amount of money available, and a reset of the actual relationship to make it much more cooperative as well.
Yeah, and in Wales, so I'm a Welsh MP, and in Wales, the attitude from the Welsh government has always been open and conciliatory and wanting to work with the trade unions in collaboration. And everything in respect to the public sector has been really, really geared towards that. So it's sort of more normal in Wales for that to happen. But obviously in England, it's been a completely different approach, really.
So let's just pull back now and look at the whole bill and its likely progress in 2025. There's a lot of complexity here for both the committee and then Parliament as a whole to consider and scrutinise, as well as the House of Lords.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking through it as well, and yes, it's not a thriller, is it? It's not a piece of fiction that you'd like to pick up in a quiet evening.
As Rosalind said at the beginning, this is potentially the most significant set of employment law changes in one piece of legislation since the 1990s, maybe, or even 1970s. And it's being put through Parliament very quickly. I think there was a real rush to introduce this bill within the first 100 days of the government, because that's what had been committed to. But that's probably come at the cost of a lot of details still needing to be worked out.
That was exactly what I was going to raise, that the fact that even though the bill, when you look at it, is extremely loquacious and takes up a lot of bandwidth, the word salad that you have to wade through, then realise, well, actually, it's all going to be thrashed out in consultation and regulations. I mean, do you see that that's going to be a problem? And this is a question for both of you, that quite a lot of the substantive changes made by the bill will be in the form of regulation that won't be subject to proper parliamentary scrutiny. That has been a criticism of the bill.
So I think, Henry, you and your colleagues have got your work cut out to really get to grips with this and try and make sure that not only is it fine intentions, but it actually does achieve practically the protections for workers without damaging the economy. You're trying to do it as much as possible. I think one thing to note, and again, we mentioned this already, is that the proposal seems to be that quite a few of these proposed changes will take some time to come into place. So there will be time for employers and workers to get their heads around them and work out how it's going to work in practice, as well as, maybe less positively, that a lot of this is going to have to be worked out in regulations. So I think, as well as your work out on this bill, Henry, you're going to have an awful lot of secondary legislation to look at over the next couple of years.
Well, I think, you know, when practicing law, that kind of stuff is very frustrating because you don't have any oversight of it. But from a parliamentary point of view, you know, the minister will obviously come and give statements, you're subject to questions. So, you know, we do get that ability to scrutinise, you know, and ask questions of the minister in the House, in the chamber. Now, I appreciate there's only 650 MPs. So I suppose if you're a lawyer or a trade union member, or, you know, it is frustrating that there is that level of restriction from a legal perspective. You know, if you're a lawyer or a trade union member, you can get into it if it's not in the form of secondary instrument.
A lot more work. This is all very good news. Good. Well, we may well be revisiting this topic a few months or perhaps a year or so down the line. Thank you both very much for coming and explaining this, both from the coalface and from a lawyer's point of view.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rosalind, and lovely to see Henry and have him join us again.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row,